Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes in the Epistle of Jude. We're in verse 1 still. Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, the brother of James, to them that are sanctified by God the Father, preserved in Christ Jesus, and called. And so we're going through a section on being called and being sanctified. And we're doing the state of the called, sanctified in God the Father is actually where we're at. And then he's talking about the state, which is sanctified. And then as subpoints of that, we went through last time what it is to be sanctified, or finished that. And now today we're here to go on to why God's called people must be sanctified. And that's where we're at. That's where we're at with this for today. So we'll go ahead and continue. So secondly, let me now show why God's called people must be sanctified, and that briefly and in few words. Although I think he goes on here for a while. Number one, for the honor of God, of every person in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit. For the honor of the Father, that his choice may not be disparaged. Ephesians 1:4, he hath elected us to be holy. 2 Thessalonians 2:14, chosen to the sanctification of the Spirit. There is some conscience in the world that makes them adore strictness. Mere morality has some majesty with it in the eye of nature, but especially gospel holiness, whereas looseness is looked upon with scorn and contempt, so that his chosen people would be a dishonor to him if they were not sanctified. Therefore, God the Father aims at it in all his dispensations. He chooses us that we may be of a choice spirit. As when Esther was chosen out among the virgins, she was purified and decked with ornaments and had garments given her out of the king's wardrobe, so we are made holy, being chosen by God. And then he calls us that he may put this honor upon us in the eye of the world, to make us like himself. Be ye holy, as he that hath called us is holy. 1 Peter 1:15. It were monstrous that God should set his affections upon a people altogether unlike him, that he should call them to be so near himself that continue corrupt and carnal. It is the aim of his providences, as well as his special grace. We are afflicted that we may be partakers of his holiness. Hebrews 12:10, threshed that our husk may fly off. God certainly delights not in the afflictions of his people. No, he loveth the prosperity of the saints. Psalm 35:27. But he had rather see them in any condition than see them sinful. Again, it is for the honor of God the Son, whose members we are. Head and members must be all of a piece, like one another. It were monstrous that Christ should have such a body as Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, where the head was of pure gold and the thighs brass and the feet iron, etc. And it were an odd sight that a face of Europe should be put upon the body of a Negro or Ethiopian. And as strange and odd it is that Christ should have a disproportioned body quite unlike himself, yea, it is little for his honor that he should be the head of an ulcerous body as well as a monstrous body. So much of sin as you continue, so much you disparage your Redeemer and put him to shame. Therefore, all Christ's aim is to make us holy. For that end, he redeemed us, that he might sanctify us and make us a glorious church without spot and wrinkle. Ephesians 5, 26 and 7. When Christ was upon the cross in the height of his love, he was devising what he should do for his church to make her honorable and glorious, and he pitched upon sanctification as the fittest blessing that he could bestow upon us. Every distinct society must have some distinct honor and privilege. Now Christ had set apart the church as a distinct society to himself, and therefore he would not bestow upon her pomp and worldly greatness. Other societies had enough of that, but holiness, grace, which is our splendor and ornament. Psalm 93, verse 5, holiness becometh thy house, O Lord, forever. And indeed, this was a far better gift than any outward greatness and excellency could be, for moral excellencies are far better than civil and natural. It is God's own honor to be holy, therefore it is said that he is glorious in holiness, Exodus 15:11. He is elsewhere said to be rich in mercy, Romans 10:12, Ephesians 2:4, but here, glorious in holiness. His treasure is his goodness, but that which he accounts his honor is his holiness or immaculate purity. As you know, among men, their wealth is distinguished from their honor. But in this gift, Christ has not only respect to the excellency of it, but to our need and want or lack. Christ was then repairing and making up the ruins of the fall. Now we lost in Adam the purity of our natures as well as the favor of God. Therefore, that the plaster might be as broad as the sore, he would not only reconcile us to God, but sanctify us. His blood was not only a price, but a laver, which is something to wash with, wherein to wash us and to make us clean. As under the law, there was in the tabernacle a great laver as well as an altar to show we must be washed and sanctified as well as reconciled to God. And Christ came not only to abolish the guilt of sin, which is against our interest, our peace, and comfort, but also to destroy the power of sin, which is against God's glory. And as this was Christ's aim in redemption, so also in the gospel and all the precious promises of it, he died that ordinances might be under a blessing and conduce to the promotion of holiness. For so it is there, Ephesians 5:26, that he might sanctify us by the washing of water through the word. There is a treasure of grace purchased and left in the church to be conveyed to us by the use of these ordinances. So John 17:19, I sanctify myself for their sakes, that they may be sanctified through the truth. Whenever we come to the word or enjoy the use of the seals, we may expect to reap the fruits of Christ's purchase. Celsus objected against Christianity that it was a sanctuary for villains and men of licentious life. Origen answered him that it was not a sanctuary to nourish them in their evil practices, but a hospital to cure them. As under the law, all the cities of refuge were cities of Levites and schools of instruction, so Christ has made the church a school wherein to learn the trade of holiness, and the word and the seals and all the ordinances look that way. Lastly, it is for the honor of God the Spirit that the called people should be holy, because they are his charge in pupilage to the Holy Ghost for this end and reason, that they may be sanctified. Sanctification is made his personal operation, the sanctification of the Spirit, 2 Thessalonians 2:14, 1 Peter 1:2. He is to shape and fashion all the vessels of glory to deck the spouse of Christ with the jewels of the covenant. This is the great advantage that we have in the economy and dispensation of grace, that we have God to purpose it, God to purchase it, and God to work it, the Father, Word, and Spirit, who agree in one to sanctify the creature and make it holy. Now it is a great grief to the Spirit when the work does not go on and prosper in the soul, for he worketh us to this very thing, and is therefore called the Spirit of Holiness. It is not for his honor to dwell in defiled temples and to let the called people go naked and without their ornament. Well, then you see, God, for his honor's sake, will have his purposes accomplished for which he chose us, and Christ his purchase made good, and the Spirit, who is left in charge to see all accomplished, he goes on with the work. Number two, another reason why we must be sanctified is because of the hopes to which we are called and the happiness which we expect. Now, we cannot have it unless we be holy. Hebrews 12:14, without holiness no man shall see God. We are bidden in that verse to follow peace, but chiefly holiness. For it is not said that without peace no man shall see God. Peace may be often broken in the quarrel of truth and holiness, and so God's children may be passively men of contention. But for all that they shall see God. But those that are not holy, he cannot endure their presence, and therefore they shall never see his face and enjoy him hereafter. Usually, by a fond abuse, we restrain the word saints to the saints departed. Aye, but we must be saints here, or else we shall never be saints hereafter. I mean true saints, for by another abuse, the word saints is made matter of pretense in some, and matter of scorn by others. But to the saints indeed, that is all the evidence you have to show for your interest in your glorious hopes. What should others do with heaven that are not saints? How can they see God that have not a pure eye? A dusky glass cannot represent the image. The degree of vision is according to the degree of sanctification. And what should a carnal heart that knows no other heaven but to eat, drink, and sleep, and wallow in sensual delights, do with the inheritance of the saints in light? The apostle says we must be made meet for such a state, Colossians 1:12. The vessels of glory are first seasoned with grace. Alas, otherwise carnal men can no more tell what to do with heaven than swine with pearls. We do not look for a Turkish paradise, but a sinless state, not to bathe our souls in carnal pleasures, but to be consorts of the immaculate Lamb, Christ. Our hopes engage us to holiness. 1 John 3:3, he that hath this hope purifieth himself as Christ is pure. If his heart be fastened upon such a hope as to see Christ as he is, and to be like him both for temper of soul and state of body, certainly he must needs be a holy man. He will be practicing and trying here upon earth how he can conform to Christ and begin his happiness as well as he can. Certainly, he that expects that his body shall be like to Christ's glorious body, he will possess his vessel in sanctification and in honor. He cannot use his body that is under so great hopes merely as a strainer for meats and drinks and a channel for lust to pass through. His mind that shall see God, he cannot fill it with chaff or suffer to be occupied with vanity, toying thoughts, and vile or worthless vile cares and unworthy projects. And his affections that should cleave to God inseparably, to be prostituted to every base or low object. Thus, with respect to our hopes, we must be sanctified. The foundation and seed of glory is laid in grace, and that life begun which we must live forever. Use number one, it serves for conviction. If God's people are a sanctified people, then here is but sad news for two sorts of persons. Number one, the profane that care not for holiness. God has no birthright for such Esau's. The portion of the Lord are a holy portion, but these have a spot that is not as the spot of his children. Deuteronomy 32:5. See what John speaks of such persons as wallow in their filthiness. 1 John 3:8. He that committeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sinneth from the beginning. He that trades in sin and makes it his work and business. You may presume that you belong to God, but you are of the devil. You have not indeed the least pretense of a claim, and do not go so far as hypocrites, being so little careful to be holy that you are not moral. Are you called? From what? Where is the least evidence of it? Aye, but our hearts are better than we show for. This is to appeal to a witness that cannot be found. It is all one as if a man should claim to another's land and pretend that he has lost the evidences. Your guilt is written in legible characters that he that runs may read it. So again, those are the profane and they care not for holiness. Number two, it convinces persons that scoff at holiness. Scoffing is the overflow of gall and malice and a black mark, let it be found where it will. In the general, it argues a bad spirit, but especially when religion is made a byword and a reproach. When you deride men for their holiness, you deride them for that which is the express image of the glorious God, and so deride God himself. Holy brethren, as the saints are styled in Hebrews 3:1, should no more be a disgrace than Holy Father, as God himself is styled, John 17:11. You hate God more than you do the saints, if you hate them for their holiness, which shines in them with a faint luster, but is infinitely and originally in God. Take heed of the chairs of scorners. Those are dogs that are without, Revelation 22:15, that bark at the splendor of God's image, that make saints a word of disgrace. Scoffing Ishmaels that will be mocking are sure to be cast out, Genesis 21:9. They do not belong to God. The apostle interprets that mocking to be persecution, Galatians 4:27. So it is in God's account, and yet it is always found in those that are born after the flesh. Profane spirits think religion a matter of nothing, and men are wont or often to mock at those which make a great matter of what they account nothing. Oh, remember, holiness is the badge of those that which are the Lord's called people, and it should be a matter of reverence, not reproach. Use number two, again, it serves for caution to prevent mistakes. Christians, look to your sanctification. Psalm 4, verse 3, know that God hath set apart him that is godly for himself. The beast's worshipers, the worshipers of the beast, have the beast's mark, Revelation 13:16. So also God's children are stamped with his seal and impress, 2 Timothy 2:19. The foundation of the Lord standeth sure, having this seal, etc. They are sealed with a mark of preservation. The Lord knows those that are his. And they are sealed with a mark of distinction. Let everyone that nameth the name of God depart from iniquity. As Cain is stamped on both sides, so has God's seal a double motto, one that notes his owning the saints, the other that notes their temper and disposition. They depart from iniquity. Take heed then, have you this seal and impress? There are many things that look like sanctification, but are not. I shall touch upon four: civility, formality, restraining grace, and temporary grace. Number one, civility, which is nothing else but a fair demeanor in the world, or in the apostle's expression, a fair show in the flesh, a darker representation of holiness rather than heathenish strictness than Christian. Heathenish strictness than Christian. You may decry it by these notes. Number one, it is usually accompanied with ignorance and little knowledge of God's institutions. Men live well, are no drunkards, no swearers, but know little of God, have no insight in matters of religion, like Nicodemus, a strict Pharisee, but grossly ignorant, John 3, verse 10. Spiritual life begins with knowing and ends in the rational strictness, and what they do upon principles. This is how it is for them. Conscience is swayed by the acknowledgement of God's will. Others live plausibly, but know not the ground and reason of their actions, and therefore are soon satisfied, never troubled about imperfections, because where there is no light, there is not that tenderness which is found in real Christians who look into that the purity of the law and are troubled because they know so much of the will of God and do so far come short of it, as is a clear glass, the least mote is soon espied. So if you have a clean mirror, you can see the mote in your eye. Number two, there is little of Christ in such souls, for a man that is satisfied with his own righteousness does not prize Christ. Paul, a Pharisee, counted his works gain, which afterward he found to be loss, Philippians 3:7. By gain, he means an advantage to procure the favor of God. Self is wont or often to take up all their thoughts, and therefore moral strains suit more with them than gospel comforts and doctrines that breed faith. The law is more natural to men than the gospel, and therefore, with those that are of a moral disposition and know more, it finds better entertainment and welcome than the gospel does. There is no hungering and thirsting after Christ. They do not see the need of the sweetness of his grace, of the help of his spirit, going on in a plausible moral course without rub or difficulty. Whereas in the spiritual life, Christ does all, and every day they see more cause to bless God for him. Galatians 2:20. Number three, usually there is some great prevailing sin. Civility is but a freer slavery. One way or another, Satan holds them captive, and their honesty and fair show to the world is but to serve their carnal interests, to hide a lust or feed a lust, which is like a corrupt desire of the heart. And most commonly, this sin is worldliness. Christ's young man that had kept all those things from his youth had great possessions, and they were a great snare to his heart, Matthew 19:22. The sin of the Pharisees was vainglory and ambition. Some morsel there is reserved under the tongue, some sin kept with a greater allowance from conscience and the less shame from abroad, because otherwise the life is fair and honest. Number four, there is a greater care about actions than lusts, again, corrupt desires of the hearts. Wrath and pride and wanton thoughts are digested because there is no violence or uncleanness in the conversation or their behavior. It doesn't actually show, even though it's still in their heart. Civility is all for the carriage, nothing for tempering the affections to such an order and moderation as becoming grace. Paul complains of his lusts and the law of sin within, Romans 7, yea, of such sinful workings as do not fall under the cognizance and discovery of the light of nature, Romans 7, verse 7, the first risings and stirrings of sin forbidden in the 10th commandment, the least rebellion of nature. Thus for civility. So it's end of civility, the point, first point. So the next main point there, there are many things that look like sanctification but are not. So that was civility. Number two is formality or pretended grace. You may be deceived in that, and therefore the apostle speaks of a true holiness, Ephesians 4:24, in opposition to that which is feigned and counterfeit. Now, false grace is always acted by foreign and external considerations, as puppets have not a principle of life within them, but are moved by an external force. The hypocrite's principles of motion are without him or outside of him, as carnal respects, self ends, or purposes, things geared toward promoting self and for his own ends, etc. True grace has an inward propensity to comply with the will of God. There is a law upon the bowels, by ends worked by constraint, and carry the soul contrary to its native inclination. A man would not do such a thing were it not for such ends. Therefore, the apostle says, 1 Peter 5:2, feed the flock that is among you, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. When a man acts genuinely in a work, his own heart carries him to it more than all outward encouragements. You have a heart motivation to do something, so you're much more inclined or ready to do it than being forced by outside encouragements. Again, false grace is shy of God's presence and sight. Pretenses are to deceive men. Therefore, such persons strive to get God out of their thoughts. They know his eye will find them out. But now truth of grace is ready to draw everything into God's sight. Though they tremble to think what defects God can find in them, yet they appeal to him for the sincerity of their hearts. John 21:17, Lord, thou knowest all things, and thou knowest that I love thee. He would not excuse miscarriages, yet for the general temper and bent of his heart, he refers himself to God's omnisciency. So Job 31:6, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. And yet elsewhere he says in Job 42:5-6, mine eye seeth thee, and therefore I abhor myself in dust and ashes. In the one place he appeals to God, for he was confident that his integrity would hold weight. And yet in the other, he could even loathe himself when he thought of God because of so many defects and failings. So David in Psalm 139:23, search me, O God, and know my heart, etc. No doubt David was sensible that God could find enough in him. But Lord, search, see if anything be allowed with full leave of conscience. Again, false grace does not grow unless it be worse and worse. Pretenses wither rather than thrive. God complains, Jeremiah 7:24, that they went backward rather than forward. False grace is always declining till it be wholly or fully lost, like bad salt that loses its acrimony and smartness every day till it be cast to the dunghill. But now true grace, from a grain, it grows into a tree. Matthew 13, from a morning glimpse to a perfect noon. Proverbs 4, verse 18, from smoking flax, it is blown up into a flame. The least meal in the barrel and oil in the cruse, when it is fed with the supply from heaven, shall prosper into abundance. Nicodemus, that at first came to Christ by night after boldly declaring himself for him, John 19:39. Grace gets ground upon the flesh, and holiness by degrees advances into a triumph. Examine then whether you increase or decrease. If you go backward from zeal to coldness, from strictness to looseness, if you lose your care of duty and choiceness of spirit, and there be no complaining, it is a sign grace was never wrought in truth. Once more, false grace is not accompanied with humility. When men, the more they profess, the prouder they grow, and more self-conceited, there is cause for suspicion. With true grace, there always goes along a spiritual poverty or a sense of our spiritual wants or lacks. The more knowledge, the more they discern their ignorance. Compare 1 Corinthians 8:2 with Proverbs 30, verse 2 and 3. The more faith, the more they bewail unbelief and see a need of increase and further growth. Mark 9:24, Lord, I believe, help mine unbelief. Oh, I want faith or lack faith, what shall I do? Still, I am haunted with prejudicial and lessening thoughts of God's all-sufficiency and goodness. It is excellent when the soul is thus kept hungry and humble under our enjoyments, and we forget the things that are behind, because the things that are before us are not yet attained, are much more. Philippians 3, verse 13. So that was the end of formality. And the next is number three, is restraining grace, which is nothing else but an awe put upon the conscience, inclining men to forbear sin, though they do not hate it. Now you may discern it, this partly because love is of little use and force with such kind of spirits. They are chained up by their own fears. The great evangelic motive is mercy. Romans 12:1, I beseech you by the mercies of God. The heart is most ingenuous when it yields to such entreaties. It is good to serve God with reverence, but a servile awe has little of grace in it. It is true, indeed, it is better to have a slavish fear than none at all. Therefore, David says to them that would be held in with no other restraints, Psalm 4:4, stand in awe and sin not. To cool and charm their fury, he makes use of the argument of God's vengeance, though this is also the fault of slavish spirits, that carnal respects and thoughts of outward inconveniences do equally sway them as a servile fear of God's judgments. Again, you may know it because it does not destroy sin, but only prohibits the exercise of it. Abimelech's lust was not quenched, yet God withheld him from sinning against Sarah, Genesis 20, verse 6. The heart is not renewed, though the action is checked, or stopped or prevented, as Israel had an adulterous heart toward God when her way was hedged up with thorns, Hosea 2:6. Again, it is their trouble that they are held in the stocks of conscience. They would fain be enlarged and find out their own paths. Number four, the next thing that looks like sanctification but is not is common grace. This is a distinct thing from all the rest, yet I call it common grace because it may be in them that fall away and depart from God. It differs from civility because it is more Christian and evangelical, from formality because it is only in pretense and show, whereas this is a real work upon the soul, and from restraining grace, because that is only conversant about sins and duties out of a servile awe of God, but this seems to carry out the soul with some affections to Christ. It is a common work, good in itself, which God ordains in some to be a preparation and beginning of the work of grace. Of this the Apostle speaks in Hebrews 6, verses 4 and 5, where he calls it an enlightening, or a taste of Christ and of the powers of the world to come, and a partaking of the Holy Ghost, meaning the gifts of the Spirit, abilities for holy duties, etc., of all which elsewhere, he'll speak elsewhere about it apparently. Only now let me note three things. Number one, that the light there spoken of is not humbling. Number two, the taste is not ravishing and drawing out the soul after more of Christ. And number three, their gifts are not renewing and sanctifying. So number one, the light is not humbling. He says they are enlightened, but he does not say they are humbled. Foundations totter that are not laid deep enough. The more true light a man has, the more cause of self-abasement will he find in himself. You can never magnify Christ enough, and you can never debase self enough. And certainly Christ is most exalted when you are most abased. Isaiah 2:19. Dagon must fall upon his face if you mean to set up the ark. And if Christ shall be precious to you, you must be vile in your own eyes. None have such true revivings as the humble. Isaiah 57:15-16. True humiliation is far from weakening your comforts. It makes them more full and sure. Therefore, a main thing that was wanting or lacking in those spoken of in Hebrews 6 was humiliation, and their fault was a rash closing with Christ in the pride of their hearts. Number two, their taste was not ravishing and affecting the heart so as to engage it to seek after Christ. They had but loose and slight desires of happiness, glances upon the glory of heaven and the comforts of the gospel, which possibly might stir up a wish. Oh, that I might die the death of the righteous, etc. They were not serious and holy desires they didn't have serious and holy desires after Christ, after grace and strength to serve him. The saints that have a taste groan after a fuller communion in his graces as well as comforts. Romans 7:24 and Psalm 119:5. That experience which they have had of Christ makes them long for more. And even Christ himself, in communion with him, I think he said that, yeah. But now in temporaries, there is a loose assent and slight affection, a taste enough to prevail with them to make some profession of faith for a while, a rejoicing for a season, etc. Number three, their gifts are not renewing and sanctifying. Such possibly as may make them useful to the church, but do not change the heart. The apostle says they were made partakers of the Holy Ghost, that is, had some share, it may be a plentiful share, of church gifts so as to be able to carry on duties to edification and comfort of others. But alas, what is a man the better if the heart be oppressed with sins in the meantime and be not upright with God? 1 Corinthians 13:1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity, I am become but a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. Though you can speak of the things of God with much enlargement and affection, pray sweetly, all is but as tinkling with God if there be not saving grace. It is a great evidence that we are such as the apostle speaks of when the affection does not answer the expression of a duty, nor the life, our knowledge, and the gifts have not a proportionable influence upon practice. And so much for that point. And I believe that brings us to the end of the main point where the state of the sanctified. So those are the called, and they're sanctified in God the Father. And we just finished, I believe, the state that they're in, which is sanctified. And Lord willing, we plan to go on the next time to who is the author of that, which is God. So Lord willing, we will plan to do that next time. But until then, go in God's humility, and Lord willing, we'll talk to you again soon.